Good day. Today is Monday, 13th October 2025, and before I proceed with the remainder of my video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if you like this video after you've watched it, or if you've liked whatever part of the video you choose to listen to and watch. Well, with that, let me now get to the substance of the video and let me discuss briefly I wouldn't say that they're less important matters, but matters about which I have perhaps less to say. Today marks the first stage in implementation of phase one of the ceasefire in Gaza, and there are reports today that all of the remaining hostages who are still alive, 20 in total, have now been released by Hamas and have returned to their families. It seems that another 28 hostages, who Israel believed were still under the control of Hamas, have died over the course of the last 2 years of captivity and fighting. Well, this is a dreadful tragedy. It seems to me, from what I can remember, that only a minority of the hostages who were still alive at the time of the earlier ceasefire last year, at the start of this year, have survived and have now been released. Of course, I might be wrong about this. But anyway, it does seem as if a significant number of the hostages have died or been killed over the course of this terrible 2 years of conflict. And I don't want to talk just about the hostages, because of course tens of thousands of others, Palestinians in Gaza, of course, have also died. Nonetheless, I am going to repeat that the release of the hostages, and presumably of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, is in and of itself a good thing and should be welcomed. Now, there is no word so far of any progress in negotiating the terms of phase two of this very complex plan to bring peace to Gaza. President Trump himself, I understand, is now in the Middle East. I've seen reports that he has, in fact, attended the Israeli parliament, where he was apparently rapturously received. Anyway, that is a report I briefly saw. I haven't read it through properly. And he appears to be heading to Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, where other Arab and Western leaders are gathering, all with a view to trying to find ways to consolidate the truce that has been negotiated in Gaza, and perhaps to rebuild the community and the buildings and the town there, which are, of course, utterly devastated after 2 years of war. In my opinion, whatever discussions take place in Sharm el-Sheikh, they might conceivably be helpful, but the really difficult negotiations are going to be taking place in the next few weeks and months. And so far as I can see, the people who perhaps ultimately matter in moving this process of negotiation forward, Hamas and its various regional backers, they are not going to be participating in this meeting at Sharm el-Sheikh. And one does worry that just possibly we could be seeing another iteration of Eve Smith's rule, that the West spends all its time negotiating with itself and coming up with elaborate agreements which are completely detached from realities and are of no interest to the other side. Well, I hope in this case it won't be like that. Now, one particular Western leader who is going to be in Sharm el-Sheikh is President Macron of France, and I think that is wrong. Macron has shown an intense and close interest in events in the Middle East ever since he became president. He has taken the initiative recently in trying to get recognition, international recognition, of the Palestinian state. He has been, well, a kind of critic of the war in Gaza. So he does have an interest and he has played a role. But nonetheless, it seems to me that at this particular point in time, he should be in France. He should be in Paris, because all of the indications are that the French political crisis, of which he is the proximate creator, is about to take a further potentially disastrous turn. Now, as I think I mentioned in my programme yesterday, last week we had the resignation of his latest Prime Minister designate, his old friend and associate, Sébastien Lecornu. Lecornu was unable to put together a cabinet or come to agreements with the parties in the French National Assembly in order to present a budget. So he resigned, and there was a lot of talk that Macron had reached the end of the road and would call parliamentary elections. And there was also talk that he might have to resign. And in fact, there were suggestions that he should resign, made by political figures like Macron's own former Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, who undoubtedly harbours ambitions to become French president himself. Anyway, Macron did none of these things. He didn't resign himself. I never thought he would. And he put off again the decision to call French new parliamentary elections. Instead, he instructed Lecornu to devote another 48 hours to finding means to establish a government that would have support in the French National Assembly. Lecornu said that he would do this, he would act on Macron's instructions, though he had no intention of becoming Prime Minister of France himself. Well, we finally got to Friday. Lecornu told Macron that he'd made some progress. It's very unclear what that progress actually was, just saying. And we were all waiting to see who the new Prime Minister of France, who would be announced on Friday, would be. And there were lots of speculations that it would be this time somebody from the centre-left. I understand Monsieur Cazeneuve, who I understand has been Prime Minister before, was the most widely expected figure to be nominated. And instead, what happened was that Macron renominated Sébastien Lecornu, who over the last few hours has announced a new cabinet, which, surprise, surprise, looks to be essentially the same cabinet as the old cabinet. All of the ministers and the key economic ministers, the finance ministry, the budget office, and those others, well, they remain in place. So, unsurprisingly, the National Rally, Marine Le Pen's party, have indicated that they will not support this new government and are proposing a vote of no confidence against it. Jean-Luc Mélenchon's left-wing group is saying that they won't support this new government either and apparently intend to vote against it in the vote of confidence that is now being tabled. Macron apparently made a big effort to get the Socialist Party to agree to support this new government, but the Socialists are furious that Lecornu was appointed instead of one of themselves, and it seems unlikely that they will vote for this new government either. And the centre-right party, Les Républicains, which Macron has tried to build a coalition with, apparently it is infuriated because Macron appeared at one time to be reaching out to the socialists. I'm not going to waste time, more time, discussing the various machinations and intrigues that are taking place in France. Frankly, I find them all tedious and boring. Suffice to say that it's the same government as before. It's not a government that the French people are interested in or appear to want to support. And it is likely that it will lose the coming vote of no confidence in the French National Assembly, at which point, presumably, Le Cornu will have to resign as Prime Minister for a second time, but this time once and for all. Now, what happens then? Here's, of course, the unresolved question. Does Macron go on proposing prime ministers, even as the economic situation in France deteriorates? I've been reading an article about how the situation in France is becoming more unstable and how the bond markets are becoming restless and are beginning to give indications, people who work in them are beginning to give indications that they cannot continue to buy French bonds or hold on to French bonds whilst this whole issue of the government of France and of the budget continues to be unresolved. Or does Macron do that which he has consistently refused to do, which is to call parliamentary elections? And unsurprisingly, since the announcement of Le Cornu's appointment, there's been a cluster of further demands that Macron himself stepped down, though unsurprisingly, he again has refused to do so or even to give consideration to that possibility. Well, we are seeing this thing protract and prolong. And to be clear, the economic crisis, not just in France, but in the whole of Europe, is deepening. I read with interest that in Germany, which it seems to me is now unequivocally in recession, consumption of beer has fallen sharply and breweries are starting to close down. Some of the famous breweries in Germany that make German beer, beer which many people consider to be the best in the world, that industry is now starting to feel the pressure. Anybody who has any knowledge or experience of Germany would know that the moment when the Germans start to give up on their beer and their breweries start to shut down is an important moment in the country's economic and perhaps political history. And perhaps that's where we are now. But to repeat again, this is all part of the wider crisis, which currently, if we're talking about Europe, has its epicentre in France. Now, one way or the other, and however this is resolved, and whatever it is that Macron intends to do, it seems to me that his duty as France's president is to remain in Paris, to remain in the Elysee, to support his new prime minister, who is, of course, his old prime minister, in whatever way he possibly can, to consult with the various political parties in the French National Assembly, to take wider soundings amongst the political nation in France, which is not identical to the French political class, and which is, by the way, enormous. Those are the things that the President of the French Republic should be doing. As far as I am concerned, it is an abdication of Macron's responsibilities to go to Sharm el-Sheikh and to spend time there discussing an issue, the Gaza ceasefire, where he and France can anyway only be a marginal player. But unsurprisingly, that is exactly what Macron has decided to do. Of course, Macron doesn't want to spend time talking to France's political nation. He doesn't want to talk to the leaders of the French political parties. He doesn't want to address the complex underlying problems of France. Doing all that ultimately bores him. He doesn't want to dirty his hands by making compromises which political leaders in these kind of situations sometimes must do. He is far happier meeting with these leaders in faraway Sharm el-Sheikh, people that he likes and understands and amongst whom he feels himself to be amongst friends, than he is dealing with the problems of France. And in this, Macron is absolutely typical. After all, in Britain, people call the Prime Minister, never hear Keir, because Prime Minister Keir Starmer is so often away. In Germany, they have been calling Chancellor Merz, Friedrich Merz, the foreign policy chancellor, because he seems to devote so much time to him. So Macron, in this, in giving the impression that he's much more happy and far more comfortable in this sort of company than he is amongst the people who he is ultimately responsible to, well, in that he is no different. Anyway, this is all I'm going to say about this today. No doubt when we get a clearer sense of where the crisis in France is going, I will have a lot more to say, and no doubt at that point we will discuss it also on the Durand as well. Now, the rest of this programme I'm going to devote to two topics. One is the conflict in Ukraine. The second is the trade war between China and the United States, which is now heating up. But I am going to speak first about the programme in Ukraine. Yesterday, I discussed what it seemed to me was the increasingly catastrophic military situation that Ukraine is facing. I said that it seemed to me that the situation has reached a decisive point, that we are looking at a potential crisis, even a catastrophe, for the Ukrainian army in eastern Ukraine, in Donbass and Kharkiv and Zaporozhye regions in Ukraine, and that this crisis, if it plays out in the way that all the indications suggest it will, could be the breaking point in the war. And I discussed the situation in Pokrovsk, where it seems to me that the Ukrainian army is now on the brink of being encircled, or perhaps is encircled already. In Kupiansk, where I don't think there's any real doubt any longer, where a cauldron is underway in existence. Even the Institute for the Study of War has published a map which all but confirms the fact. And in Siversk, where, by the way, over the last 24 hours, there's been a cascade of reports from Andrei Marochko, our old friend, and, by the way, Denis Pushilin as well, the head of the Donetsk regional government, that fighting is now taking place within the city limits of Siversk itself, that there are now battles going on inside Siversk. The Russian general staff hinted that this was already the case about a week ago, but now we're getting a lot more reports about this, though no video footage so far. There have, by the way, been some reports, if we're talking about Siversk, that the Russians have entered the village of Dronovka that lies to the east of Siversk. This village, Dronovka, is close to the main supply road that goes to Siversk, ultimately from Slavyansk. And, well, all of that, if true, if the Russians really are fighting inside Dronovka as well as Siversk, well, all of that does indeed point to a battle that is now reaching its culminating point. Anyway, I said that it looked to me as if we were now on a point of at a point of crisis. And well, shortly after I said that, two people who I suspect are probably better informed about the situation than me basically said the same thing. One was the blogger who writes the Substack blog, Events in Ukraine. He's given an overview of the military situation on the battlefronts. Perhaps the greatest emphasis has been on the fighting in Pokrovsk and in the area northeast of Pokrovsk, where the Russians carried out their breakthrough. He provides a cascade of comments by Ukrainian military commentators and reporters, all of whom confirm that the situation in Pokrovsk and in the area northeast of Pokrovsk is turning critical for Ukraine. And well, he did appear to think that the situation for the Ukrainians is deteriorating on the battlefronts, and he provided significant amount of information that appeared to support that conclusion from the Ukrainian side. But perhaps an even more interesting discussion of the situation on the Ukrainian battlefields comes from the Russian war reporter Marat Khairulin. I have pointed out how back on the 20th of March, he wrote an article in which he appeared to outline with startling accuracy the future offensive that the Russians would conduct over the course of the summer of 2025, and how many of the things that he predicted would happen over that the course of that offensive have indeed happened. Well, in his very latest piece, which you can also find, by the way, on his Substack blog, translated again by Zinder Nerf, the person who calls himself Zinder Nerf, you can see that the same he thinks he said he thinks the same thing. He talks about how the Russians are now basically poised to achieve decisive outcomes and how these might be just over the horizon. So he says things like this. And what can be seen about the situation in the special military operation, this well-fortified area in the Donetsk People's Republic, with a developed transport network densely built up with cities and settlements among around numerous industrial enterprises and mines, has been left by the Russian command for development in the final phase of the SFMO. That phase will come when Ukraine's economy is destroyed and the armed forces of Ukraine are weakened and demoralized. That favorable condition will form then favorable conditions will form for the cracking of this strong nut, he means Donbass, with minimal losses, and that moment is approaching. Preparations are being made and advantageous lines are being occupied for the elimination of the last large node of the armed forces of Ukraine on Donbass territory. And then he makes a very interesting comment, which requires, I think, some unpacking. He says this: impatient citizens, of course he means Russians, incited by hasty bloggers and experts, and he puts the word experts in quotation marks, ask the standard provocative question, Why couldn't it be done earlier? Dear compatriots, war is primarily about economics, and the general staff is a huge calculator that constantly calculates. Striking the enemy's territory, especially deep inside, with expensive missiles, without coordinating these actions with operational tactical combat areas is self-destructive. The enemy has many options to compensate for the damage caused by establishing detours, redirecting flows, etc. We all know perfectly well that the collective West is trying to damage our country's economy, weaken our armed forces, and eventually destroy us. Therefore, the West provokes expensive but low offensive actions. The right time has come, the necessary conditions have been created, and the isolation of the areas of direct interest has begun. The main task is the demilitarization of Ukraine, the destruction of the Ukrainian army. Now, as I said, this is very typical Russian formulation. And as I said, it tells us an awful lot, but it does require some unpacking. What Khairulin is saying is that the Russians are now at that point where they have occupied so many important positions and their forces are so properly organized that they can finally break Ukrainian resistance in Donbass. And notice how he describes Donbass. He describes Donbass as this area where there is a developed transport network, densely built up with cities and settlements around numerous industrial enterprises and mines, which is, of course, is what I have been saying many times. This is essentially a place of urban sprawl and therefore very, very difficult for armies to manoeuvre through. And I would add that there is aspects to the geology of the area that makes it difficult for armies to manoeuvre through as well. There are many rivers and streams, small rivers and streams, and this area gets particularly badly waterlogged in the autumn and spring periods, and the ground is often very soft, and it's difficult especially for armoured vehicles, tanks and such things to move. And on that note, by the way, I would just make an observation, which is that we are currently entering the period of the Rasputitsa, the period of the autumn mud. It's come apparently rather early this year. There's been quite a lot of rain. There's an awful lot of fog, apparently. And this normally limits the ability for offensive action. Except it is not quite turning out this time, because there is no evidence that on this particular occasion, on this particular autumn, the Russian army is slowing its offensive in any place and to any degree. It is once again using many more tracked vehicles, infantry fighting vehicles and tanks, to move infantry. Infantry are not marching to the battle places as they have perhaps been doing in recent months rather a lot in order to avoid the drones. And we see perhaps rather less of the motorcycles. But the point is that despite the Rasputitsa, despite the autumn mud, the Russian army continues its advance. I suspect this is partly because the Russians are able to use tracked vehicles to a much greater extent than they have been able to recently in the war, because they have gradually got on top of the whole problem of drones on the battlefield. They have swamped out the Ukrainian drones from the area, the combat area, on the battlefield. Their drones dominate. The Ukrainian drones don't. And they've perfected means to shoot down or jam the Ukrainian drones. Just saying. But I suspect it is also because the Russians have now reached the built-up areas in the cities, the last line of defence that the Ukrainians have in Donbass. And in urban areas like Pokrovsk, Siversk, Kupiansk and Konstantinovka, and over the course of the last 24 hours, Russian commentators have started to confirm that fighting is indeed taking place inside Konstantinovka itself. Again, the Russian general staff about a week ago suggested that this was the case, but now we are finally getting reports from the Russian bloggers and Telegram channels which appear to be confirming it, though still we haven't received any actual video proof that this is really the case. Anyway, I suspect that a lot of the fighting, because it is taking place in built-up areas, it means that the Russians aren't affected by the mud so much. Because, of course, in a city, in an urban landscape, the mud is not such a problem. On the contrary, there are suggestions that in some parts of the battlefronts, the fact that we are now in autumn, that there is mist and fog and rain and low cloud cover, is actually helping the Russians, because apparently their drones can operate at least to a certain degree in these conditions, whereas the Ukrainian drones perhaps cannot. And with the Russians continuously advancing, they can use the mist and the fog and the low cloud cover to cover their advances. And it is the Ukrainians who are defending, who are at a disadvantage when this happens. Anyway, so Khairulin says that the Russians are now very well positioned to continue this advance, to break the last big defence line in Donbass. But then, going back to that very complicated paragraph in which he appears to rebuke people who talk all the time about the need to take even more drastic actions deeper inside the lines. What is he actually referencing here? He says that striking the enemy's territory, especially deep inside, with expensive missiles, without coordinating these actions with operational tactical combat areas, is self-destructive. The enemy has many options to compensate for the damage by establishing detours, redirecting flows, etc. What one has to do is to coordinate these strikes on positions behind the front lines with your advance on the actual battlefield. And he says that the right time to do this is now approaching. And he says that the objective is to destroy the Ukrainian army. The main task of the special military operation is the destruction, is the demilitarization of Ukraine, i.e. the destruction of the Ukrainian military. And then, of course, the answer, which I think explains the whole puzzle, is in the next sentence. One can chase them across enemy territory, stretching the contact line and one's own logistics, thus creating difficulties for oneself, or one can create conditions so that the weakened enemy brings their raw material to our machine for processing at their own expense. One can weaken them by inflicting defeats in operational and tactical depth, on the march, and in concentration areas which our armed forces are successfully creating. So this, I think, is a very elliptical reference to the Dnieper bridges. He's basically saying, look, yes, we could have destroyed the Dnieper bridges a long, long time ago. It would have been possible to do that. But at that time, we were far away from the Dnieper. We were not able to approach the Dnieper. And the Ukrainians, had we done that, would always have found some means to get their men and machines and supplies across the Dnieper. After all, they are assisted by the West in doing it. They could have set up pontoon bridges or other types of bridges. It would not have been an insuperable problem for them, not when the West is working for them. Besides, our objective is to destroy their armed forces. Now, I've been saying this, we've been saying this on the Durand, since the outset of the special military operation, that Russian military philosophy, the guiding principles that the Russian general staff follows, are Clausewitzian, that you achieve victory by breaking the enemy's will and ability to continue resistance. And you do that by destroying the enemy's armed forces. And what Khairullin is saying is that in order to destroy their armed forces, you can do it in all sorts of ways. You can advance against them. You can chase them across the battle lines. That will cause you heavy losses. And it will put immense stress on your own logistics, or you can advance incrementally, causing the enemy to come to you to try to hold you back, and that way you're able to destroy the enemy, to grind the enemy down piecemeal on the battlefield in a place of your own choosing. One can chase them across enemy territory, stretching the contact line and one's own logistics, thus creating difficulties for oneself. Or one can create conditions so that the weakened enemy brings their raw materials, he means their army, their newly mobilized troops, to our machine for processing at their own expense. If your objective is to destroy the enemy's army, then let them keep coming to you so that you can use your enormous advantage in military equipment and training to destroy, and numbers now, to destroy them better and more effectively in that way. And according to Khairullin, that point is now well within distance of being achieved. So, according to this logic, it's better not to destroy the bridges, the Dnieper bridges, at this time, because you want the Ukrainians to deploy to eastern Ukraine, where you can destroy them there, not to keep their forces on the west bank of Ukraine, where they are in effect beyond your reach. Now, a couple of months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst and intelligence analyst in the United States, had a very interesting discussion with a Russian general a retired Russian general, I believe it was in Moscow, and this general told him essentially the same thing. It's a strange tactic from a Western point of view, because in the West, we conduct war in such a profoundly different way from the way that the Russians conduct it. We do tend to measure progress in terms of territory captured, cities captured, armies defeated. The Russians measure progress in a completely different way in terms of the destruction of the enemy's army and thereby the enemy's will to resist. So if you see it in that way, you understand better what Khairullin is saying. But note again that Khairullin is hinting that the point when the Russians are going to move beyond this is now approaching. The obstacle, which is Donbass, is on the brink of being taken. And I have discussed in many programs that there is no other area in Ukraine that exactly corresponds to Donbass. No area that is as heavily built up, that has so many factories, so many railway lines. And railway lines, by the way, are an important barrier to advancing soldiers, because they're built on small embankments. They're in a kind of a way natural defense lines in themselves. There is nothing comparable to that anywhere else in Ukraine, and destroying the Ukrainian army there in Donbass and breaking the defenses in Donbass puts the Russians in a position where they have achieved their primary objective, the destruction of the Ukrainian army, and would therefore be in a position to bring the war to an end. I found this one of Khairullin's most interesting articles. Again, you have to perhaps read a little between the lines to understand what he's saying, but I think the ultimate meaning, at least to me, is fairly clear. Now, just to repeat again, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Russians conducted their first major drone attack on a railway bridge across the Dnieper River. Or right, it wasn't a railway, a road bridge across the Dnieper River, one of the Dnieper bridges. This was in the town, the city of Kremenchuk, a major industrial centre. And it was explained to me that quite apart from anything else, there was a specific target on the bridge that the Russians were targeting, though I have no idea what that particular target was, whether it was an individual or some piece of equipment or something of that kind. The point is, it was nonetheless the first major attack on a Dnieper bridge. And, well, I thought at the time that it happened that that might be a signal that more such attacks might be coming. And one way of reading Khairullin's article is to suggest that we are indeed close to that point, because the Russians are now advancing closer and closer to the Dnieper. They're about to break Ukrainian defence in Donbass itself. And at that point, it might make sense to isolate Ukrainian forces in various places by destroying the Dnieper bridges and basically trapping them on the east bank of the Dnieper, which the Russians mostly control. And in an earlier article, the earlier article that he wrote back in March, Khairullin described exactly how this could be done in connection with the city of Dnipro, that Dnipro could be placed under siege. It might not even need to be stormed, because destroying the bridges, the Dnieper bridges, in this specific area of Dnipro, in the city of Dnipro, would destroy the entire supply system for Ukraine and would in fact neutralize the Ukrainian forces who were still trying to control Dnipro itself, the city of Dnipro itself. Anyway, I said yesterday that we are close to a point of catastrophe in Donbass. Perhaps Khairulin and the blogger who writes for Events in Ukraine don't go quite that far, but you could see that they also think that a decisive moment is being reached. Now, that may explain all of these very complicated and very strange diplomatic moves which continue to take place even as the war itself grinds on. Now, we had more comments from the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Firstly, he seems to be more optimistic again that he might be able to achieve some kind of agreement with President Putin. I don't know what evidence he has for that, because as I've discussed in many programs, Putin has up to this point in time made no concessions at all, none that we know of, in connection with the ending of the war. He has never at any point compromised on any of the issues relating to the final terms for ending the war. He continues to insist that Ukraine must remain outside NATO, that the four regions plus Crimea must be transferred to Russia, that Ukraine must denuclearize, demilitarize, that it must change its political system, that it must restore rights to the Russian speakers in Ukraine and restore the Russian Orthodox Church. There's never been any hint from Putin that he is in the least willing to compromise or retreat on any of that. And why now would he? His armies, as Khairulin and others are saying, are now in an obviously dominant position on the battlefields. It would make no sense for Putin at this time to make compromises on points like that. But Trump continues to talk about how, yes, some kind of deal with Putin could be likely. And Trump had some really rather strange comments to make on this vexed issue of the Tomahawks. He said that he expects that there will be a deal with Putin, but that if there isn't a deal with Putin, well, he might in that case be minded to supply Ukraine with Tomahawks, and Putin won't like that at all, the implication being that the Tomahawks are this enormously devastating, world-changing, game-changing weapon system, which the Russians presumably are very afraid of and nervous about. Now, again, it's not always easy to interpret what Trump is doing, but taken at their face, it seems to me that Trump's latest comments rather support the idea that the whole talk about the Tomahawks is a bluff. It is a poker game that the Americans, the Trump, is playing with the Russians and with Putin. If you don't do as I want, I will give Ukraine Tomahawks, which sort of implies that he's not yet made the decision to give Ukraine Tomahawks and that the Ukrainians don't actually have any Tomahawks. Now, that not only seems to signal that this whole debate about Tomahawks is something of a bluff, but in a kind of a way, it rose the whole threat back. It suggests that the decision to supply Tomahawks has not actually been made, that Trump has not yet made a decision about this. And the Ukrainians themselves, by the way, in various comments that they have made, are also sort of admitting that Trump has not actually made the decision to supply Tomahawks. Now, I'm going to suggest that this may provide some explanation for Putin's conduct, his response to this whole story about Tomahawks. Now, Putin is obviously extremely well informed, and he has presumably been told by his intelligence people about the problems the United States would have if he did indeed deploy Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. Things that I have discussed and others have discussed in many programs. The fact that there is no ground launcher for these missiles, that the Typhon system is so huge and expensive and elaborate that it is, to all intents and purposes, incapable of being deployed to Ukraine. That the lighter, much lighter ground launchers, mobile ground launchers created for the Tomahawks back in the 1970s, when the Tomahawk was a purely nuclear tip weapon, that these ground launchers were dismantled way back in the 80s, and that there is no real means or method to place them back in production. It could be done in time, but it will take a long time to do it, and that this might be, well, perhaps several years away. And also, yes, the US military, the US Army, did have a program between 2023 and 2025 for a mobile ground-launched Tomahawk system. The Tomahawks still housed in their naval canisters, the ones that they have when they're launched from the ships of the US Navy, which is, by the way, the only launch system for the Tomahawk, which I understand is still in existence. But this canister system has proved to be difficult to transfer to mobile vehicle, to road mobile vehicles. Attempts to do it have been done, but this has proved a major technical and logistical challenge, which caused the Pentagon to cancel that entire program in 2025. Yes, it's possible that this could be revived also, but unless there's all kinds of secret work being done, has been all kinds of secret work being done to revive or develop the system over the last few years, which we don't know about, which is possible, but then we can't speculate on that, which we don't know. But unless there has been that secret work already been done about the system, of which there is no hint, then again, given the complexity of the technical challenges and what we know about the challenges the US defense industry has in placing complex systems of this kind into production, we're probably looking at least a year, probably much longer, before these systems, these lighter systems, would be able to enter service and would be able to play an actual role on the battlefields. So anyway, we have all of these problems, and Putin knows about those. And he obviously also knows, this has undoubtedly been briefed extensively, about how Simply launching a Tomahawk missile is not a simple matter. How it requires massive inputs from various levels of the US intelligence and command chain, though I suspect Putin by this time in the war can be under no illusions that if necessary the US would greenlight and participate in all of that. After all, we now know, since the Financial Times has told us, that since July, the United States has been assisting Ukraine to conduct drone strikes on Russian oil refineries. By the way, there have been some claims that that article in the Financial Times is wrong, that the information it is giving is untrue. I have no doubt whatsoever that it is true. I have no doubt at all that the United States has indeed been assisting and indeed guiding the Ukrainian drone strikes on the Russian oil refineries. The Russians have been repeatedly saying for weeks that these kind of attacks on their refineries could not take place without direct input from the United States. So the Financial Times article tells us nothing which the Russians have not already been saying. And anybody who has any understanding of this issue knows that without the United States, almost certainly it could not be done. So I doubt that Putin has any doubts about the willingness of the United States to participate, to involve itself in command and guidance decisions where Tomahawk missiles are concerned. But he probably does know or believe that actual deployment of these systems is probably at least a year away and perhaps much longer. So, given that this is so, he probably realises that Trump is bluffing, that this is all a bluff, that Trump is using the threat of the Tomahawk missile deliveries to Russia in order to extract concessions. And Putin and the people around him are saying to themselves, well, the way we deal with this is by showing to the Americans that we are not, in fact, intimidated by what the Americans are threatening to do. So instead of running around and saying, well, you know, if the Tomahawk missiles are sent to Ukraine, this will be a tremendous disaster. It will be a military crisis. We will have to take extremely strong countermeasures. The Russians are perhaps saying, or at least the people around Putin are perhaps saying, that the correct way to respond to this is to play it down, to say, well, these systems are old, they are easy to intercept, our air defense system will have no trouble dealing with these missiles. Let's not give Trump any reason to think that by threatening us with Tomahawk missiles, we are rattled and nervous and perhaps ready to make concessions. I will come to how that approach plays in Russia in a moment. Now, if this is correct, then there is some kind of toing and froing going on behind the scenes between the Americans and the Russians. The Americans are saying, or at least Trump's people are saying, agree to freeze the conflict or we will get Tomahawks against you. The Russians saying, we don't care, bring it on. We're going to press forward with the war in the meantime. So all of that might be taking place, and there might be those kind of contacts. But I come back to the wider Russian response in all of this. Because though I can understand why Putin himself might be taking this approach, he might be saying that a stronger reaction to rumours about Tomahawk deployments will actually play into the hands of the hardliners in the United States. They will seize on it as evidence that Putin and the Russians are rattled, and that will make them even more determined to send the Tomahawks in order to escalate the war. Well, while I can understand why Putin himself might make that calculation, I doubt that many other people in Russia are making it. I suspect that many people in Russia are saying, what is the point of all of this? Trump is already orchestrating attacks on our oil refineries. He wants to supply Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles. He's talking about doing it. Even if it's quite true that telling Trump, don't do this or else, is more likely to make Trump go ahead and do this. And even if you don't want to give the impression that you're rattled by this threat of Tomahawk missiles, does it not make far better sense to say to yourself also, negotiations with the United States of any kind make no sense anymore? Trump really isn't listening to what we are saying, isn't listening to us about Istanbul Plus, our various demands. He doesn't really want to address our underlying concerns, what we call the root causes of the conflict. And for that reason, further contacts with the Americans are pointless, and we should focus instead on the war. And not only is that debate, I have no doubt at all, taking place in Moscow, but we saw how, as I discussed in my recent program, Putin is going along with part of this. I have no doubt that the Russians do have a plan when they reach the Dnieper, to cross the Dnieper and to move to try to take control of the remainder of Ukraine's Black Sea coast and Odessa and Nikolaev and other places, Ochakov and all of the others, those other places as well. And I have no doubt that that plan exists, and I am confident that when he met with the generals in St. Petersburg, Putin did indeed tell them, you have my green light to work towards it and to go ahead with it. But I think that Putin, at the same time, still wants to sort out relations with the United States, still hopes to come to some agreement with the United States in order to secure Russia's western border. And though it is frustrating to many people in Moscow, he still speaks about an eventual understanding with Donald Trump and the Americans. And here I'm going to say where, again, I think the major misunderstanding Putin and the Russians might have comes from. I've developed the impression from some of the things that Lavrov and other Russians have said about the meeting in Anchorage, that Putin and the Russians came away from that meeting thinking that Trump is prepared to negotiate over the future security architecture in Europe. And I think Putin doesn't want to jeopardize that negotiation when it eventually happens. But I think, again, this is a red herring, because I don't think that Donald Trump or anyone else in the West, in the United States, is in fact interested in holding with that Russians that kind of conversation or that sort of negotiation. Putin almost certainly brought all of that up over the course of the Anchorage meeting. Trump, as he always does, seemed to agree. Putin came away with an impression that he'd reached an understanding with Trump on this precise issue, except I don't think, in fact, he really did. Now, in the meantime, tensions in Europe continue to be extraordinarily high, but there's a number of things to say. I'm going to discuss the deterioration of China-US relations in a moment, but the key thing to take from what has happened between China and the United States over the last couple of days is that it should bury once and for all any idea that the United States can use China to exert leverage over Russia. The Chinese made a very deliberate step, took a very deliberate step to restrict rare earth exports to the United States. They must have known that this would provoke an extremely strong reaction from the United States. The entire mood in Beijing, as we will see shortly, about a trade war with the United States is bring it on. Now, if that is correct, then any idea that the United States is going to be able to force China to stop imports of energy from Russia ought to be buried. Far from the Chinese being intimidated by those kind of tariff threats, we have seen that on the contrary, and on a completely different set of reasons, they have preempted what the Americans might do. And it is the Americans who are now trying desperately to find a walk back. So that's one thing I want to say. The sanctions threat has basically melted away. Even the ideas of seizing ships on the high seas, Russian tankers on the high seas, even that idea is apparently encountering massive problems and grave doubts within Europe and is being quietly dropped. I ought to say that apparently there's been investigations of the various drone incidents over the various airports in Germany, in Denmark, etc. The consensus that appears to be developing amongst Western law enforcement agencies, from what I can see, is that the Russians were not involved. And, well, as for that incident of the ship carrying the Russian oil that was seized by the French, there's been a scathing article about this incident in The Spectator, the British political newspaper. But anyway, the point is that no evidence that this ship was involved in any kind of illicit drone activities was found. So the rhetoric against Russia remains intense. But perhaps because people in Europe are again going through that process of starting to understand that they have really very little leverage, and that a clash with the Russians in military terms would be an extremely bad idea. It looks to me as if, for the moment at least, the tension is slightly abating. Now, let's return to the issue of China and the United States. We've had a long editorial about this issue in Global Times, and Global Times made it very clear that, as far as the Chinese are concerned, the decision by China on Friday to tighten controls of exports of rare earths, they have made that decision in response to what they see as aggressive moves by the Americans. They say this: the incident stemmed from Washington's threat to impose tariffs of 100% on China and export control on all critical software under the pretext of countering China's tightening of rare earth export regulations. Viewed from a longer time frame, it is the United States that has persistently used tariffs and export controls to interfere with and undermine the normal trade order between China and the United States, as well as the atmosphere of bilateral economic and trade talks, seriously harming China's interests. Since the China-US economic and trade talks in Madrid in September, the United States, in just 20 days, has introduced a string of new restrictive measures targeting China. The difficulties currently facing China-US related trade are entirely the responsibility of the US side. China has repeatedly made it clear that its export control measures on rare earths and related items is a legitimate action by the Chinese government to refine its export control system in accordance with trade, with laws and regulations. These actions are not only necessary to safeguard national security, but also fully demonstrate China's steadfast commitment as a responsible major country to pursue world peace. And then the article continues, the US has long overextended the concept of national security, misused export controls, adopted discriminatory practices towards China, imposed long-arm jurisdiction measures on a wide range of products, including semiconductor equipment and chips, yet it has hypocritically criticized China's normal regulatory measures. And economic and trade relations have been a journey full of twists and turns. And though China obviously wants better relations, China will not be pushed around. China stands firm in its position, clear in its red lines, focused on the broader stability of the international trading order. The United States, by contrast, reacts emotionally, lacking effective policy tools, mired in double standards. Well, if the United States continues to pursue unilateral measures guided by a zero-sum mindset, it will only further disrupt global supply chains, harming others without benefiting itself. So what the Chinese are basically saying here is enough was enough. We came to what we thought was a deal with the Americans as recently as September in Madrid to ease off our tariffs. This is after each side agreed to reduce tariffs back in June. And what instead has been happening since then, since September, is that the Americans have got back to the habit of salami slicing. Export controls on technology, further restrictions on Chinese exports. I discussed yesterday the fees, the chips built in Chinese shipyards might now face if they come to US ports. And well, just the other day, I think it was even yesterday maybe, the Dutch government took over control of a Chinese semiconductor company, using again national security as an excuse to do so. So the Chinese said, enough's enough. Two can play at this game. If the United States continues to go down this route, we're going to impose export controls on rare earths. We know what the effect of that is going to be on the US defense industry. We know what the effect of that is going to be on the US AI industry, dependent on chips, which depend on rare earths. So we're going to take all of these measures because we're not going to tolerate this backsliding and deviousness and salami tactics from the Americans anymore. Well, to anybody who knows about China, none of that is surprising. But the interesting thing is to track the American reaction. On Friday, President Trump publishes an absolutely enraged post on Truth Social. He then follows up with an announcement the following day that on the 1st of November, he's going to impose 100% tariffs on China again. Then the next set of comments is, well, actually, relations between China and the United States continue to be good. His personal relations with President Xi are fine. And he's still looking forward to meeting with President Xi in the APEC summit in South Korea in 2 weeks' time. In other words, just as happened in June, the Americans are retreating. The Chinese have a winning card, which is their monopoly for the moment on rare earths. Now, I understand that exports of rare earths by China and imports of rare earths by the United States from China accounts for only a small part of Ukraine's, of the US's GDP. Not Ukraine's, the US's GDP. But of course, that is to use a misleading measure, because even if the cost of these rare earth supplies relative to the enormous US GDP number is very small, if you need these rare earths to build F-35 fighter jets and to make AI chips, then you have very great problems if you don't receive them. Yes, the rest of your economy can continue as always, but it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be economic consequences. According to some calculations, 40% of growth in the US economy this year is entirely the product of the speculative boom in the US stock market on AI. If you can't get the chips and you can't get the AI, what happens to that boom? What happens to your wider defense industry? You've run down your stockpiles because you've given so many weapons to Ukraine. You need to boost production in all kinds of ways. You need to support Israel in all sorts of ways. So you don't really have those many cards to play. So unsurprisingly, once the anger has subsided, Trump is trying to retreat and trying to find a way back. Now, when I read his latest Truth Social post, I thought that there might actually have been a conversation between him and Xi Jinping, and I'm still not absolutely sure that there hasn't been. But it seems not, in which case the retreat that Trump is beating is even more obvious than it would otherwise be. Now, if the United States cannot impose tariffs in response to restrictions by China on exports of rare earths, if it is so nervous, if it understands the potentially grave crisis in its economy, if it catapults itself into that kind of trade war with China at this time, how is he going to risk imposing major tariffs and sanctions against China because, say, China buys Russian oil or sells drone technology and perhaps sophisticated chips to Russia? It can't be done. And I think that many people in the United States perhaps understand that. And I can't help but think that that, together with the deteriorating military situation, is what probably explains this whole nonsense about Tomahawk missiles. You can't scare the Russians with sanctions and tariffs, and you've provided Ukraine with every conceivable weapon that Ukraine has asked for. Threaten the Russians with Tomahawk missiles and hope that that will buy you some leverage, which, of course, it won't. Now, saying all of this, I want to repeat again what I said in my program yesterday, that we are at a decisive moment in the war. In fact, I read on a Russian Telegram channel that the situation in Pokrovsk, as of the time of making this program, is starting to bear a close resemblance to the situation in Avdeyevka 2 years ago, just before that fortified cities fall, fortified towns fall. And Avdeyevka was an extremely important defense position for the Ukrainians. But Pokrovsk is an order of magnitude more important still. After all, it's much bigger, if nothing else. So if Trump wants to avoid a disaster in Ukraine, a political disaster in Ukraine, he should not be wasting time talking about Tomahawk missiles. He ought to be calling Putin and calling Zelensky and saying, look, Vladimir, whichever Vladimir it is he's talking to, Tomahawks are really not an option. Let's instead do what we ought to have done previously, which is to negotiate with the Russians on the basis that Putin outlined a year and a few months ago when he spoke to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024 and outlined Russia's conditions for ending the war. In all other respects, the war is lost. Tomahawk missiles are not going to change the situation. They're a reckless and dangerous thing to be doing. And in the meantime, the mere discussion of them is putting Putin in an increasingly difficult condition where it becomes more problematic for him to pursue some kind of rapprochement with the United States than it might otherwise be. So let's end all of that. Let's talk instead. Let's negotiate finally in a serious way, accepting that the war is essentially lost and seeing what we can nonetheless agree. Well, Trump isn't doing that. I don't think Zelensky will ever do that. I think the Europeans won't do it either. And I mention these things with no real hope that anything like this will happen. But I think this is the point to make. If Tomahawk missiles are a bluff, it's a dangerous and ultimately pointless bluff. At worst, it will harden the Russian position. At best, it will simply mean that the Russians will continue the war until they achieve their victory and reach the Dnieper, cross the Dnieper, and move on to Odessa and the Black Sea and all of that. And at the same time, taking these kind of steps, talking about Tomahawk missiles, is increasing hopes in Europe and in Ukraine that prolongs the war, which is already lost. Anyway, that is what I think. And this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. There'll be more from me tomorrow, as always. In the meantime, let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.